supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
1206.
Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. This past December, a group of students assaulted 26 Asian students at a South Philadelphia high school. Shortly after New Year's Day, an effigy of President Barack Obama was found in Plains, Georgia, hanging from a building in a noose. Incidents like these make us wonder how far tolerance and equality have really come in this country. On today's show, we'll listen to excerpts from previous editions of Voices in the Family that touch deeply upon these issues. Later in the show, we'll discuss hate crimes and racism with two researchers. But first, Holocaust survivor Gerda Weissman-Klein and civil rights leader Morris Dees have dedicated their lives to promoting tolerance and equality. A few years ago, they shared an extraordinary personal experience with us in front of a live audience. But first, Gerda Weissman-Klein talks about what she endured under the Nazi regime during World War II. Your story starts in Poland when the Nazis invaded your town. You were 15 years old. You had your family, your beloved brother, age 19. Tell us what happened prior to that horrible day. What was your family like? What were their values, their dreams?
Well, in retrospect, my family seems absolutely ideal. Looking back, I don't think my parents could have been as saintly as I remember them. I think it must have rained in Poland occasionally. But I think of my childhood of absolutely sunny. And I went to school and I thought my life will go on like that forever. And then on the morning, to be exact, at 9:10, the morning of September 3rd, 1939, a Sunday, a beautiful day, the world I knew and loved and was a part of was irrevocably destroyed. I endured first about 3 years, from 1939 to 1942, from the time I was 15 till 18. My brother was taken away immediately. I stayed with my parents, first in the basement of our home, later in a very bitter ghetto, and I just turned 18 when I was separated from my parents, never to be seen them again, on a journey of slavery, to slave labor in concentration camps, which lasted for 3 years. There was another dimension which lived there, which gave one hope for the ultimate goodness of humanity, and that is the love, the friendship, the caring and the sharing which existed, which gave one hope for the ultimate goodness of humanity. And since who perished there left no children behind, you all are the spiritual heirs, and you must know of the greatness of the legacy that was left to you. When sharing a crust of bread, or the story I talk about a friend of mine who once found a raspberry and carried it in her pocket, all day long to give it to me that night on a leaf, but she never tasted a raspberry again. And I think that in memory of those who so nobly lived their lives under horrible circumstances is the memorial which we can build for them to reach out to others. And I believe this is a sacred obligation, because survival is an incredible honor and privilege, but it is a deep obligation to speak on behalf of those who never had the privilege of an evening at home, of holding a child in their arms.
Gerda, hatred is contagious. All emotions are contagious. You were exposed to a great deal of hatred. Didn't you ever hate
couldn't say that I did not hate or didn't hate my captors, certainly, but I have been exposed to an equal measure of love and caring, not only before my childhood, but even in the camps.
Tell us about the woman in the slave labor camp, the German woman.
The German woman's name was Frau Kügler, and it was the first camp we came into. And I remember when the gates were closed, it was such a finality, and we were captive, and she came. She really did not have a resemblance to a human face. She looked like a bulldog, and her voice was a screeching, horrible voice. And I said, oh, my God, we are going to be doomed with her here. And she really pinned a lie to the lips of all those who said they had no choice. No doubt she was picked by the Gestapo to be in charge of us by her demeanor. But she was a very kind, caring human being. Nobody was sent to Auschwitz. As a matter of fact, she dragged me one day to the factory when I and two other of my friends were excused. We were running a high temperature, and Lindner, this famous horrid person who, when he came to a camp and found anyone not working, took send him immediately to Auschwitz. She dragged us to the factory, literally. She put my looms in motion, and she said, pull yourself together. Today, it's life or death. And she was carefully watched, no doubt, being in the position that she was in. But she showed a degree of humanity which gave me hope that perhaps not all of them are evil.
When you were taken to the labor camp, people in the community stared at you with hatred in their eyes. You were a part of that community. You had been a part of that community. Yeah. And then in very short order, you were the subject of hatred. You were a 16-year-old girl. How did you understand being hated for who you were? How did you...
It's very difficult to explain that, you know. I cannot say that I was always raised with this sort of thing, but I lived in Poland, and I was going to school. I always had a little bit of a flair for writing. And twice a year, we could write an essay, which, and if it was chosen, it was published in something similar to what we have here, the scholastic things. And lo and behold, one day, I won. And, of course, it was great rejoicing. My God, I was republished in everything Polish there and so on. And a few months later, when there was another time, it was usually twice a year, my father took me for a little walk. And on the walk, he said to me, doesn't a thing coming about to write another essay? And I said, yes. And he said, you better don't try too well. It wouldn't do for a Jewish girl to win twice. And I never thought, why not? If I'm a good writer, why not? You assumed the thing that you didn't make waves, you didn't push yourself forward, you accept that role, sort of in good grace. Yes, Papa, you're probably right, I shouldn't do a good essay. And I suppose that this attitude must have helped them when the Nazis came. But, oh, my God, did it change when I came here.
What changed? You didn't come to this country with courage to speak.
No. But I must mention, for the benefit of those who do not know my story, that I was liberated by a young American on the end of the death march, when I weighed 68 pounds, my hair was gray, I was in rags. I hadn't had a bath in 3 years. And here was this handsome young American, and he became my beloved husband of 56 years. And I remember when we landed in New York, when the wheels touched the runway, his arm was around me, and he said, you have come home.
I want to bring it up to today. You talked about that 68-pound girl who was rescued. Last month, I had the privilege of being at the United Nations with their first annual Holocaust Remembrance Day, where you spoke to a worldwide audience about your experience. And all I could think about while you were speaking was that 68-pound girl. And what a transition it's been for you. What was it like speaking to the world?
I can say it was an out-of-body experience. I really didn't feel I was there. I saw myself at the beginning of the death march, which started 61 years ago, with two lines of 2,000 girls each, and I asked myself, why am I here? But I can tell you when it started, I don't want to take all the time. It really started as soon as my husband brought me home. And he said we had to go to Niagara Falls because no honeymoon is complete about Niagara Falls. We went in the company of his friends, and I viewed the falls and the magnificence of it, and then we went to dinner in the old Niagara Hotel, which was fabulous, you know. There was napery, and there was enough food, and I had come from worst of Europe, you know. I gobbled everything. And then a friend of Kurt's, his oldest friend, got up, and he started talking about President Truman, and he said some very unkind things about President Truman, you know. And people started listening to us. We had, you know, attracted a lot of attention. And I started grabbing Kurt and said, stop him, stop him. I understood enough, you know, English for what he said. And then Kurt's friend turned around and he said, I'm a Democrat. I voted for President Truman. I put on this little show for this young lady. She's new to our country. And I wanted her to see what freedom of speech really means. Everybody laughed and went back to their dinner. I didn't sleep that night. I didn't tell Kurt, but I was sure that he must have been arrested during the night. And the next day I made Kurt call him on some pretext, and they talked like nothing happened. And from then on, whenever I had occasion to go to Niagara Falls, you know, whenever company came, I always made a little tour around the old Hotel Niagara. To me, it is like the Washington Monument. This is when I learned freedom of speech, and God knows I never stopped talking.
We're listening to excerpts from a conversation with Holocaust survivor Gerda Weissman-Klein. She grew up in Poland and is the author of several books, including her autobiography, All But My Life. She also helped start the Gerda and Kurt Klein Foundation to teach students about tolerance, respect, responsibility, and community service. Coming up after the break, we'll hear from civil rights leader Morris Dees. He was one of the founders of the Southern Poverty Law Center, which is internationally known for its victories against white supremacist groups and other hate groups. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and you're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY. FM.
Waldorf schools in Kimberton, Philadelphia, and Princeton support WHYY and encourage listeners to attend their January open house events. Celebrating 90 years of Waldorf education with over 1,000 Waldorf schools worldwide, Waldorf schools strive to provide an educational foundation that honors each phase of a child's development while nurturing creativity and independent thinking. Waldorf school locations and open house details are online at tristatewaldorf.org.
Coming up this afternoon on Fresh Air, the story of Satchel Paige, one of baseball's greatest pitchers, from his biographer Larry Tye. He says Paige played to the stereotypes whites had of blacks, but also quietly defied Jim Crow in the South. The details coming up this afternoon on Fresh Air at 3 o'clock on WHYY-FM. The WHYY forecast, partly sunny with a high around 50 degrees this afternoon. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low near 31. And tomorrow, a mix of sun and clouds with a high around 48 degrees. It's 47 degrees in Center City at 1220. This is WHYY-FM.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. As the country honors the legacy of Martin Luther King, we're listening back to some of our favorite interviews that deal with issues of tolerance and equality. Before our break, we heard Gerda Weissman-Klein's story of suffering and survival during the Holocaust. During our conversation, we were also joined by civil rights lawyer Morris Dees. He grew up in Alabama and left a career in publishing to defend victims of racism and bigotry. Morris, your story begins on an Alabama farm where you witnessed injustice. Everybody witnessed the same thing back then that you witnessed. Somehow you saw it as injustice. Everybody else saw it as regular life. What is it about you, your vision, that knew that there was something unfair, unjust going on in your world?
I wish I could express myself as clearly as Gerda as to why I do what I do. I can't even imagine going through the suffering that Gerda did to bring her to where she is today, which is a monumental position. I think probably my family didn't own any land. We were sharecroppers, tenant farmers. And unlike most of the white guys that I grew up with in my little small cotton farming community, I worked in the cotton fields. They didn't. It'd be unusual in my area to find a white farmer and his family out picking cotton in the fields. We did. I did because I wanted the dollar I got for every 100 pounds I picked. And so when you're out in the field working with somebody and you're listening to their stories and you're going into their homes at night in the day and you're playing with their children, you see, and they're living on a dollar and a half a day, working 12 hours a day, you see the gross injustice that they receive. And my uncle ran a country store, and he had what he called his white person's price, and excuse the expression, but he had his nigger price. And he let me work in his store on weekends, and when a white lady came in to buy a jar of mayonnaise, her price would be 25 cents. When a black lady came in to buy the same jar of mayonnaise, he'd make me charge her the nigger price, which would be 35 cents. And she had no money, had little or no money. And it just didn't seem fair or right. Now, to answer your question, why would I see that differently than most of the white guys who would laugh at that? If I told that story, that'd be a big joke. You know, that would be, my uncle would be considered a smart guy, a sharp trader, taking advantage of powerless, helpless people. I guess it probably was because of my parents. I had the same kind of parents that Gerda had. My dad set some examples for me, which I think are important, a lesson for all of us, because more people are watching you than and will do what you do than you'll ever preach to people and tell them what to do, I found out. But my dad would be out in the cotton field working, and I remember one time my job was to carry the water, a big heavy bucket of water from the well. When I got back to the field with the bucket of water, this black lady took a dipper and got a dipper of water, and my daddy was chopping the cotton row next to hers, and when she got through drinking, then he picked the dipper up and got a drink of water. Well, in Alabama, whites didn't drink after blacks. We had white water fountains and water fountains for African Americans. And I didn't notice it at the moment, but it was quite obvious to me, you know, later in life. And that's one of many, many examples. My uncle, I'm not sure he hated the most, my dad or the blacks in the community, because my dad, blacks would come in our house and they'd sit at our table. And my mother would work closely with blacks to assist them in filling out complicated forms and things of that nature. My mother was a justice of the peace. And I left home, you know, to go to college. I wasn't a civil rights lawyer. I wasn't an activist. I left home to go to college to be a lawyer to make some money so I could buy some land that nobody could make me move off of so I could be a farmer. But I remember when I first got to college, the most striking example of thing that changed me was 1956. Actually, it was 1955. I started school, college, and that was the year that a court ordered the University of Alabama integrated. They ordered a young woman named Arthur Reen Lucy to be admitted, and when she arrived on the campus, there was approximately 10,000 people there to protest her being there, Ku Klux Klan, turning cars over in the streets, and the students were told not to go out of the classrooms, but I did. At that point, you know, we all believed in segregation. It wasn't, you know, I wasn't a liberal, I wasn't a conservative, it's just I believed in the way of life we had. But as I watched this young black woman walk across the campus towards the administration building with a priest walking beside her and a mob swirling around, throwing rocks and bottles and stuff, I backed up on the steps of the Union Building there on University Avenue in Tuscaloosa, and every feeling I ever had for the underdog came out, because that same young woman was just like the ones that I'd picked cotton with in the cotton fields.
Name those feelings.
Well, it was a sick feeling of watching a mob. If nobody's ever seen a mob, to see 10,000 people rocking Greyhound buses and turning cars upside down, is the mob has a mind of its own. That was one feeling. Secondly, I didn't want to be a part of that mob. I felt disassociated with them. And I also felt like I wanted to get out there and, you know, knock a few heads. You know, I wanted to protect her. I wanted to get in there and defend for her.
And the feeling was anger.
Well, it was anger. It was compassion for her. It was anger. It was frustration that nothing I could do about it.
Is that what you felt when you sold that jar of mayonnaise? Did you have similar feelings?
Yeah, I felt sad then. I felt sad that the black lady was having to pay more, because I worked with the same black lady in the field and got my $1.50 at the end of the day, and she got her $1.50, and I thought it wasn't fair.
One of the feelings, I would imagine, back then and maybe in college, was, in addition to compassion and outrage, maybe a sense of helplessness or impotence.
Possibly. I'm not sure about that. I didn't think about that. But I do know this, though, that I was a superintendent of the Baptist Sunday School. Everybody's Baptist in Alabama. And so I was married when I got to college, so I was superintendent of the married Sunday school. And it was a big church with a couple of thousands, the university's big church there. And so they let me be the superintendent of Sunday school. And so what you did when you had your Sunday school, you first went together in a big group and you read a few Bible verses and had a little devotion, and the people went to their classes. Well, this was the Sunday after Arthurine Lucy had been rejected. She was rejected. And I remember starting off the thing saying, I'll read something from the Bible. And so I read them from somewhere in John. I've kind of disassociated from the Baptist, no pun in there, but since. So I said, you know, in 1 John, in this devotion, I said, you know, in the Bible it says, how can you love God whom you've never seen, yet you hate your neighbor that you see? And everybody's saying, amen, that sounds good. And then I said, this last week, we rejected Arthurine Lucy from the University of Alabama, and we don't even know who she is. We never met her. And when I said that, everybody in the room's head dropped. You know, I mean, they really were not happy about that. And so when we went on about the class, well, that week, the minister of the church, a very big church, came to my marriage student apartment at the University of Alabama and said, you know, we've decided to make some changes in the Sunday school. You're a very fine person, and your preacher at your little Baptist church back home said you'd be a good person to have up here. But we think that we need a person with a little more experience, and he never mentioned that incident. And I was relieved of being superintendent of the Sunday school just like that.
You're telling your story to a psychologist, and I take a slant on it that I'd like to pursue.
Sure.
That you got up in front of this church and nobody else would, I don't think. Certainly nobody else did. And it speaks not just to your vision of injustice, but it speaks to something inside of you. It speaks to your tolerance of being different, of being alienated. It speaks to your tolerance of standing alone.
That's possibly true, because I remember when 1963 came, I came back home to practice law in 1960. 1963, the 16th Street Baptist Church was bombed in Birmingham. Four little girls died that Sunday simply because of the color of their skin. And I was superintendent of Sunday school still. I hadn't totally given up on the Baptists. And I got back in my little rural community, and I live on a farm, and I always have. And so I stood up to do my devotion. Here again, I'm still superintendent of Sunday school. I guess they never heard about the Tuscaloosa thing. And so I said, this morning, before we go on our classes, I'd like for us to take up a contribution for a fellow Baptist church that had an incident that damaged the church severely, and I think it'd be good if we took up a contribution. And so everybody was nodding their head like, that's a good idea. And then I said, and I'm talking about the 16th Street Baptist Church. It was bombed in Birmingham last week, and a lady stood up in the back. I'll never forget her, Mrs. McNeil. God bless her soul. She's about 6 feet two, weighed about 110 pounds, and she'd been a missionary to Africa, and she had retired and come back home. And she had been over there, trying to proselyte all these heathens, as she called them. And so she stood up in the back of the room, and she said, Little Morris, my dad is Morris, she said, Little Morris, that's none of our business. We shouldn't be involved in that. And so I said, so I stood there, I said, well, we'll just say a prayer for them. So I bowed my head to say a prayer. And when I finished and looked up, the whole group had walked out of the church. And I was standing alone.
You were standing alone. Mm-hmm. And you're okay to stand alone. Few people are. You've spent a good deal of your life, of your work, standing alone. It's painful.
I don't want to interfere with your psychoanalysis here, but...
Sorry.
But... it's hard.
I don't have a comeback line.
I'll have to tell you this. I don't think that to me, maybe then, maybe now, I don't know what devil made me do it. Maybe I've always been a lawyer at heart, but I don't think that I have a greater feeling than standing up in a situation, that I think is right, that I... representing somebody or defending somebody or some cause that I really truly believe in. And I've had enormous family support too. I sued to integrate the Montgomery YMCA because they closed all the city parks and pools and filled them up with dirt, and because they couldn't have segregated parks and pools after Brown versus Board, and they didn't want white girls in the pools with black boys. That's what it's all about. And I remember filing that lawsuit and had a courageous federal judge who ruled for us and integrated all the YMCAs, et cetera. And I had, my daddy had been killed in a car wreck in 1961. And so I had three uncles and an uncle-in-law. And they all came to my office and dressed in their coats and ties and all and walked in and sat down and said, they need to talk to me. I said, well, yes. And they said, we would like you to change your name. You're ruining our family's reputation, and you should change your name. And if your daddy was alive, he would take you to the woodshed. That meant I'd get a whipping. And so I looked at them all sitting there and said, guys, I appreciate you coming down. I can certainly understand how you feel, but I think I'm doing what I want. I think I'm doing what's right. And boy, they gave me some strong language.
We've been listening to excerpts from a conversation with Holocaust survivor Gerda Weissman-Klein and civil rights lawyer Morris Dees. Coming up, we'll talk about intolerance with Chad Dion Lassiter from the University of Pennsylvania and Mark Potok of the Southern Poverty Law Center. We'll discuss hate crimes, racism, and ethnic bigotry. More important, how communities can overcome intolerance. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and you're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY FM.
It's 47 degrees in Center City at 12:35. This is WHYY FM.
Acting Company, the resident ensemble players, supports WHYY. Presenting She Stoops to Conquer, January 21st through February 20th at the Roselle Center for the Arts in Newark, Delaware. Wily women, devious rascals, and spirited hijinks lead to a country house of confusion in this lighthearted romantic comedy. For tickets, 302-831-2204 or on the web at rep.udell.edu.
It's legal in just 3 states, and yet the experts say
there is a large underground practice of physician-assisted suicide in the other 47 states. This is widely understood and to some extent documented.
We're debating the new Montana ruling and the other end-of-life choices that grab our emotions. Join the Health and Science web chat at noon Tuesday. WHYY.org/healthscience.
The WHYY forecast, partly sunny this afternoon with a high around 50 degrees. It's 47 degrees in Center City at 12:36.
Welcome back to Voices in the Family. Today we're honoring the legacy of Martin Luther King. When we hear about hate crimes, we wonder what could drive people to commit these violent acts. We recently spoke with Chad Dion Lassiter and Mark Potok to understand the nature of these crimes. Lassiter is an adjunct professor at the University of Pennsylvania Graduate School of Social Policy and Practice. Mark Potok runs the Intelligence Project for the Southern Poverty Law Center. Mark, let's start with you. You draw a distinction between hate crimes and racial incidences. So an effigy hanging of Obama on a college campus, would that be an incident or a hate crime? What's the difference?
The difference is that there's an underlying crime that's defined, that is actually out there in the law, an assault, an act of a threat or criminal incitement or any one of a number of things, an assault and battery, whatever it may be. You know, in the case of an effigy hung on a university campus lawn, I would think there is no underlying crime. It might be different if you hung an effigy on someone's lawn in a way to try and intimidate that person. I think that pretty clearly would be a crime. But when you don't have an underlying crime, then it has to be an incident. It just doesn't rise to the level of a hate crime.
So the distinction has no bearing on how much harm it causes, because both.
That really is true. I mean, I think people commonly think when hate crimes are mentioned, people think of them as these independent category of crimes. In fact, hate crimes is merely shorthand for crimes which are punishable with a hate crime enhancement. In other words, if I assault you because you stole my girlfriend, I might get 6 months in jail. If it was because, I'm attacking you solely on the basis of the color of your skin or a category like that, I might end up serving 2 years. And that would come in the penalty phase of the trial.
So, Mark, let's go back to you. First of all, crimes do seem to occur more frequently on campuses. There was an article I referred to in the beginning of the show that was written in the Philadelphia Inquirer. Why is that?
Well, first of all, let's say, it is university and lower school campuses are the third most common venue in America for hate crimes, which really is surprising, at least on the face of it, that after streets and in homes, residences. The last FBI report shows something over 11% of these crimes occur on campuses. I mean, why is that? I think for a couple of reasons. I think, first of all, people wrongly assume that university campuses are going to be kind of bastions of open-mindedness and so on. And I think the reality is that campuses really reflect the society that's around them. They're not so very different from the society that's around them. A couple of other things. One is that you get a lot of kids arriving at university who really have not been outside of a very narrow life until that moment. In other words, perhaps you've been raised in, an all-white or virtually all-white suburb and really have no experience of other kinds of communities. And the final piece, it seems to me, is that these are, universities are places where young men congregate, and young men, as is, well known to all criminologists, are the people who commit the vast majority of all kinds of crimes, certainly crimes of violence, not just hate crimes. So I think those things working together are what really are behind the fairly large numbers of these things we see on campuses.
Chad, being a victim of a hate crime also means that you've spent a lifetime being part of a group that is hated, and that's what you bring into the situation. So tell us about the implications of that, of living in a group that is hated racially, sexually.
So when we look at hate crimes and what other people use the terminology of bias-motivated crimes, we know that they occur when a perpetrator targets a victim because of his or her membership in a certain social group. And so you're absolutely right, Dan, in talking about these social groups and how they're defined as racial groups, religion, sexual orientation, disability, ethnicity, nationality, and sexual orientation. And so having that particular social group and being a target of a hate crime simply along those lines is really traumatic. And so the implications do lead to depression. It leads to post-traumatic stress disorder. It leads to not wanting to go to class, not wanting to go to school, not wanting to go to work and things of that nature. And it can have profound impact for an extended period of time as well.
When we're living in a group that is hated or disliked by the larger public, I assume we live with a level of stress that's just there, that's just baseline.
High stress levels, also forms of coping. Do we cope adaptively? Do we cope maladaptively? And so if you look at what Jews have had to endure here, when you look at the lynchings of African Americans and just the challenges that African Americans and others across, you know, demographic lines have had to endure, the stress levels are high, forms of institutional racism, forms of just challenges that people have been dealing with as it relates to being marginalized, being oppressed, just dealing with the everyday occurrences really brings about a lot of health challenges for people on a day-to-day basis.
Let's widen the lens a bit, well, quite a bit, mm-hmm. and let's go back to our history as humans. It's been around forever, racial and ethnic hatred. I'm sure it preceded the Jews being enslaved in Europe. I mean, we're you know, tribal people, and there's always one tribe that's going to be threatened by the other tribe. It continues in Bosnia and Darfur. Will it ever go away?
I think it's going to be with us for as long as we exist. But the challenge I think that we have to really look at is every day we should try to get up and try to find ways that we can combat it, we can dismantle it, and that we can actually do things from a social change perspective to bring about an end to it. I just think that, you know, when we look at it, as you articulated, that it's been with us throughout many centuries and it's going to continue. But I think that we still lend our passions, our hopes, our aspirations, as well as social change tactics to uproot it. So I think there are a lot of things that we could do to bring about effective strategies in combating hate crimes and forms of discrimination.
Let me ask you to play, it's unfair, play evolutionary psychologist for a minute. And I'm seeing if this has been around forever, must be there for a reason.
Well, you know, we have forms of xenophobia. We always look at people as strangers in our midst. If you look at some of the challenges that, you know, happened with the ethnic cleansing in Bosnia, there was someone who had to be a bully, and that's maybe not the right terminology to use, but there had to be someone that was in a position of power, and they wanted to oppress a person. If you look at what we went through in our history in the United States and the way that we've displaced the, you know, the Native Americans, and if we bring up to what happened with the Ku Klux Klan as well as African Americans, there seems to be someone who has to be inferior, and they want to make someone else to be inferior. And so one of the challenges that we've had is that we've always had this dynamic of other, and we've always seen people as other, and we've never really focused on our similarities. What we do is we magnify our differences twofold, and then what we do is we put some in a marginalized position.
Do you know in the Bible it says you shall imbue the head of a goat with all the sins of the people and banish the goat forever? And that is the origins of the concept of scapegoat. You know, all the stuff about yourself, your people that you want to disavow, you know, you attribute it to somebody else and you go after that person.
You're absolutely right. Instead of looking at our full humanity, looking at some of the challenges that we have, sometimes it's difficult to put the mirror up and look at some of the profound challenges that we have, some of the proclivities we have, some of the things that we do to people. So what we do is we try to scapegoat others. So we scapegoat gays and lesbians. We scapegoat disabled. We scapegoat the aging. But in reality, what we're looking at also with the emergence of hate crimes on college campuses is that a lot of young people are racially socialized. We think that college campuses are going to be filled with, you know, free thought in the sense that people are going to come in and like one another. And what oftentimes happens on these college campuses is they become more segregated. And so we have young people who don't really want to deal with race dialogue. They tiptoe through the tulips, they touchy-feely, and they really don't want to talk about some of the challenges that lie ahead. So we see these occurrences at Lehigh University, St. Joseph's University and various other universities when Barack Obama becomes, you know, president-elect, and he wins the Democratic nomination. And we have people who are angry, because what does that mean to have an African-American male in the 21st century become the president of the United States? And so this hatred and all this animosity boils to the surface, and people maladaptively cope, and it manifests itself in a negative way.
Mark, is the precursor of this hatred, is it always fear?
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess you could say it's always fear. I mean, I very much agree with what's just been said. I think that, you know, what scapegoating represents very often is an unwillingness to look at oneself. I mean, you know, look, many times major changes happen outside of oneself. You know, the economy goes to hell and you're in trouble and you feel like blaming somebody else. But very often it's because, you know, I dropped out of high school, therefore I can't get a job. I was lousy to my wife, therefore she left me. You know, I'm a poor businessman, therefore my business failed. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, rather than look within, how much easier to look down the street and say, it must be because that black family moved into my neighborhood, which used to be all white and, you know, wonderful and pristine and that kind of thing. So, you know, yeah, I think that these are essentially well, I think what's really worth saying is that these are people reacting to real things in irrational ways. But it's worth remembering that there are real things out there that are occurring. I mean, you know, in the case of anti-immigrant violence, which we've seen a real rash of over the last few years, you know, the reality is that this country is changing in pretty significant ways demographically. You know, so that does not mean that certainly assaults on supposed immigrants are in any way justified, but it goes some way toward explaining where some of this violence is coming from.
And it does. The underpinnings of that are anxiety and essentially fear of loss of something.
Maybe the illusion of embedded by, you know, a number of people out there, and I'm not just talking about white supremacist hate groups. You know, I think when we talk about, for instance, anti-immigrant violence, which really has dominated the scene for the last few years, you know, I think it's very unwise to forget the role that talk radio, that certain news, cable news television stations play and so on in demonizing immigrants. I mean, you know, that is very generally what precedes this kind of violence, a demonization of a group, you know, followed by attacks on the group. Well, and it's, I think, very surprising sometimes to understand that very often hate criminals are not, you know, the sort of bottom-of-the-rung street thugs. They very often are young men who actually feel that they are doing the wishes of their community, that they are carrying out what their community would really like to say happen, although typically I haven't quite said it explicitly.
Chad, you made a comment that this culture, this country, breeds hatred. Yes, sir.
I think America is one of the greatest places to live, and I don't mean that from a placating, ingratiating, or displaying with false generosity sense. And with all the wonderful things that we have occurred in the United States of America, we also have to take a candid look at the fact that America also has a dark side. And so if you look at what has happened to the Native Americans, if you look at what has happened with the Mid-Atlantic slave trade, and when you look at what happened during Jim Crow and the way several civil rights leaders and Jewish leaders as well were treated during the civil rights movement and various other movements, there's a segment of the population, whether we call them white supremacists, neo-Nazis, that breeds hatred. And it's really profound that, you know, that's one of the things that we really don't talk about. It's not really in our textbooks. It's not anything that, you know, people really want to grapple with. It's just something that we become disillusioned about. There is something that we're in a state of denial about, or maybe we just have a mindset of amnesia. But it's something that we definitely need to look at, and something that we need to really talk about. When we look at the racial contract and everything that is Eurocentric, and everything is, you know, presupposed to be, you know, nothing getting developed into, you know, Europeans got there. And then when we look at the fact that we discount the experiences of white women as well, our election even showed that. Yes, we have 43 presidents who were white, and now we have one African-American president, but we have no women presidents. The bias discrimination from a gender perspective that was, you know, displayed throughout the election towards Hillary Clinton. And so I think we just need to really talk about, you know, the stain of America and some of the dark side of America. It doesn't mean that we don't love America, or we just need to make sure that we talk about America for what it really is and the promise of what it can become.
Mark, do you agree that this country breeds hatred? And what makes this a worrisome moment for you?
Well, I'd say a few things. I mean, first of all, I'm not a professional in this area, but my gut feeling is that, you put any two groups of people together and the better armed group is going to oppress the less well armed group. I mean, that just seems to me to be the history of the world. I realize that's vastly simplifying a great deal. I will also note an interesting thing about the people who enter at least today's hate groups. There's been a lot of work, some of our own work as well as some serious academic work, which shows that a very large proportion, almost certainly a majority of people who go into these groups, in fact do not go in for reasons of racism or anti-Semitism or hatred of gay people or any of the things one might expect. They go into these groups for very much the reasons that kids join other kinds of street gangs. And that is essentially, or at least in a large number of cases, because their own family is in terrible shape. They have some kind of dysfunctional family or family with a lot of difficulties, and essentially they go out and form an alternative family on the street. So I think that doesn't, if one believes that that is true, that's a little different than saying the American experience in and of itself engenders a kind of racial animus that's different than other societies. To answer the second question, why do we feel worried now? I think that what we're seeing right at this moment, of course, we've seen this big rash of incidents right at the end of the election and immediately after Obama's election, real racially charged incidents. I think right at this moment there's more, too, that's going on. And let me just tick off what I think are the factors out there. One, we have continuing quite high levels of non-white immigration, principally Mexican and Central American immigration, and that is driving a lot of animus in this country. Two, the prediction by the Census Bureau just a few weeks ago that by the year 2042, the United States would lose its white majority, its 50% plus one white majority. And that, believe it or not, is driving certainly the groups I cover quite out of their minds. They're really beating their breasts over this one. Three, of course, is the economy and the absolute certainty of coming worsening unemployment in the months to come. And then four, of course, is the idea of a black man in the White House. I think when you put all of these things together, for some subset of white Americans, it gives them the feeling that somehow they've been robbed, that the kind of Christian white country they imagine their forefathers built has been stolen away from them. So, I guess what I'm saying is there's a kind of identity crisis going on among some whites. I think it has calmed down quite a bit since the election of Obama, and maybe that's a promising thing or a hopeful thing. But certainly all these factors I've mentioned are the kinds of things that can engender the growth of these groups. It won't necessarily happen, but I certainly think there's a lot in place there that could help these groups continue to grow.
Well, let me take the position here of the naive interviewer, if I may, and turn to you, Chad. One could argue that racial hatred is based partly, in large part, on ignorance, a combination of ignorance and anxiety. Theoretically, one would think that hate crime would be diminishing as this country really is becoming more of a melting pot. There are more people of more subtle colors than ever before. So there should be less ignorance, less hatred.
But there still is ignorance. And I like the question that you posed. But I think it goes back to what Mark stated in the sense that we have these groups. And when these groups come together, there's still a group that perceives that they need to have advantage and another group needs to be disadvantaged. And so what we have is, yes, we see an increase in interracial dating, interracial marriages. We see more groups assimilating into, one another's culture. We see a lot of people doing a lot of things around cultural holidays and things of that nature. But there's still that underlying current that's based on this whole notion of privilege, someone's advantaged, someone's disadvantaged, and I think that's where therein lies some of the challenges that we're seeing on our college campuses.
I listened to both of you, and what I'm hearing, and I'd like both of you to react, is that the fact that a black man in the White House is not going to have much of an impact on the dialogue or in changing these broad brush dynamics that both of you are talking about. Mark, let me start with you.
Well, I mean, I think the election of Obama is a huge and truly remarkable milestone in the history of the country. I mean, we have made, you know, whatever one may think of the specific policies and politics of Barack Obama, it's a remarkable thing, and a thing a person like me never thought I'd see in my life. So, you know, not to take anything away from that, you know, nevertheless, we see these kinds of backlashes, and I don't think it's unexpected. I think that we can continue, I expect to see that continue in some form. You know, whether or not it kind of heats up around the inaugural, we will see, but it seems quite possible. You know, I'd like to just make one side point, if I may, which is that the truth is we don't know if hate crimes are increasing or if they're diminishing. It may well be that from the very beginning, our society or perhaps societies in general have seen this level of hate crimes. You know, we know for a fact that the FBI hate crime statistics cannot tell us if hate crimes are going up or down. Because the system is voluntary, and you know, I won't bore listeners with all the details, but there are very many problems with these statistics. The important point, it seems to me, is that the FBI stats show between about 6 and about 10,000 hate crimes a year, depending on the year. The reality, though, as shown, I think, very definitively by a government study, Department of Justice study in late 2005, is that the real level of hate crimes out there, they concluded, was about 191,000 incidents per year. That's, you know, 20 to 30 times what the FBI is reporting. So regardless of whether these crimes are going up or down, and regardless of what it may mean historically in comparison to other societies or our own society at other times, the point is that there are a great many of them out there. And therefore, you know, this is not a minor social problem. This is a major problem that, you know, I think we're obliged to confront as a society.
I think having Barack Obama as the president of the United States provides us an opportunity to have a race dialogue, whether or not Barack Obama calls for it. I think what it does is it provides an opportunity for people in the academy, people in the community, and people in their households to talk about things that make them uncomfortable and things that make them comfortable. And so I think it's a starting point. I think it's, for America, it's a pregnant moment as we give birth to a new identity, a new reality of what could possibly be become.
We've been listening to excerpts from a conversation with Mark Potok from the Southern Poverty Law Center and Chad Dion Lassiter from the University of Pennsylvania's Graduate School for Social Policy and Practice. Early in the show, we heard excerpts from a conversation with Holocaust survivor Gerda Weissman-Klein and civil rights lawyer Morris Dees. Well, if you've got a question or show idea, contact us at voices@whyy.org, or you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. And by the way, you can listen to archive editions of Voices in the Family on our website, whyy.org/voices. Well, the engineer for today's show's been John Knapp. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer of audio content at WHYY. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Our producers are Gita Simons and Stephanie Marutis. Jonathan Glick is our intern. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.